Morning song, we are going to begin by practicing today's first hymn, which is not in any hymn books. It is called My Grandfather's Clock. John, can we get the lyrics up on the screen, please? Yes, they are up there. Number 350.
Good morning, everybody. I have one announcement this morning. The Green Sanctuary is going to be sponsoring a course, Environmental Issues of Our Time. It will be starting in February. It'll meet once a week on Sundays from noon to 1:30. There's a sign-up sheet in the back, so if you want to learn how to do hydraulic fracturing, it's the first week. Oh, or maybe stop people from doing that. One of those two. So definitely come. You can learn a lot of different things. There'll be different topics each of the weeks. Take a look at it. It's posted on the bulletin board in the social hall, and feel free to sign up. Our opening words today come from Grumpy Cat, actually named Tartar Sauce, who became an internet meme at the age of 5 months in September of 2012, and she graces the cover of our order of service today. Every year it seems that things fall apart, and 2014 was no exception. What a disappointment to wake up to a sunny blue sky on January 1st, 2015, and like Grumpy Cat, say to ourselves, still here, worst apocalypse ever. If your internal irony meter did not go off, please check your battery now. Although we currently use the word apocalypse to mean the complete destruction of the world, its original Greek meaning is to uncover, to reveal, or to disclose. So as we stand at this point in the doorway of a new year, looking both forward and backward, what revelations do we find in our own lives, in our communities, in our human culture, and in our recent history that give us a measure of ourselves? How do we measure a year? Please take a moment to say hello and introduce yourself to the people around you this morning. Our chalice lighting words come from Tom Robbins, who has this to say: our greatest human adventure is the evolution of consciousness. We are in this life to enlarge the soul, liberate the spirit, and light up the brain. Please rise in body or spirit and join me in our opening hymn, My Grandfather's Clock. The words are up here on our screen, and Michelle will help lead us in the song this morning.
Short, never to go again.
Lake Country Unitarian Universalist Church. At LCUUC, we strive to surround this community with the spirit of love in everything we do. My name is Paul Fackler, and I'm the worship associate for this morning. As a welcoming congregation, we hope that all visitors, wherever they are on life's journey and whatever their backgrounds, will find a lasting home here. Whether you would walk a mile or 1.60934 kilometers in another person's shoes, you are welcome here. Whether you would say Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers, or that he picked 8.80976754172 liters of pickled peppers, you are welcome here. No matter who you love, what pronouns you use, or how you measure yourself in the world, you are welcome here. Please join us for refreshments and conversation in our social hall after the service today. And while you're there, stop by the welcome table to find out more about LCUUC. Today's order of service includes announcements of upcoming church activities, and we look forward to all visitors, friends, and members joining in. So please take a moment at this point in the service to silence all electronics. And again, welcome to all here this morning. We're so pleased you have chosen to come and worship with us. Now we have some special music. Care for our wider community is by contributing to our local food pantries, both financially and through the collection of non-perishable food items, which we donate each month. If you have food items to share, please bring them forward at this point in the service, or ask a child to bring them forward for you, and I invite the children to come to the front and enjoy a story.
Good morning. Did any of you get lost in the snow today?
No.
No. Good. You're going to get lost in the snow? It's a good plan. Okay. Today, I brought one of my favorite books, Where the Sidewalk Ends. So it's got poems by Shel Silverstein. Do any of you guys know who this is? A lot of you have read this, so on. It's fun. It's a fun book. And actually, I'm just going to read one of the poems from here today. And it's a pretty simple one, but I want you to think about it. So it is called One Inch Tall. So how many of you are taller than an inch? Pretty much everybody, it seems. Yeah. Wait, you didn't raise your hand. How big is an inch? Does anybody know? How big? Go ahead. About that? This big? What's that? The thumb. You know what? I just read that. That was what I was going to say. I said that. Many people say an inch is the distance from the first knuckle on your thumb to the tip of your thumb. So that's how you can guess what an inch is. So this poem asks you to imagine that you are that tall. So that's pretty small. It's going to be hard to reach for cookies and things like that in the social hall later if that's how tall you are. Yes. But if you get one, it's going to be really big. So here's an example. This is a one-inch square. So imagine that's how tall you're going to be in this poem. That's you. If you were only 1 inch tall, you'd ride a worm to school. The teardrops of a crying ant would be your swimming pool. A crumb of cake would be a feast and last you 7 days at least. A flea would be a frightening beast if you were 1 inch tall. If you were only 1 inch tall, you'd walk beneath the door, and it would take about a month to get down to the store. A bit of fluff would be your bed. You'd swing upon a spider's thread and wear a thimble on your head if you were 1 inch tall. You'd surf across the kitchen sink upon a stick of gum. You couldn't hug your mama. You'd just have to hug her thumb. You'd run from people's feet in fright. To move a pen would take all night. This poem took 14 years to write, because I'm just 1 inch tall. So, do any of you plan on shrinking yourselves this year? Coffee will make you smaller? It'll stunt your growth. Okay. Yes. That's a good plan. So anytime you get big food or really good food, shrink yourself in your mind so your food lasts extra long for you. So that's our story for today. Who's our lantern bearer?
This church is a community of ourselves. Its energy and resources are our energy and resources. Its wealth is what we share. As we contribute to the life of this community, we affirm our lives within it. This morning's offering will now be given and received. This is a time in our service where we share our joys and concerns. We do this in two ways, by speaking them aloud and by lighting candles. If you have a joy or concern to share, please raise your hand and an usher will bring you a microphone. Tell us your name and briefly share your joy or concern.
My name is Ray, and I'd like to share a concern of my younger sister, who won the battle against breast cancer 5 or 6 years ago, but now has had a serious recurrence, and she's in hospice.
My name is Jessie, and if you could please light a candle of joy. Zen Master Thich Nhat Hanh had a stroke about a month ago, and he's being moved into a stroke recovery center and is up and smiling with his monastics, and it's just huge, great news and like a New Year's miracle.
Hi, I'm Mark. I just have a good friend who's in a struggling with a lot of items right now, and so just keep her in her thoughts.
My name is Robin, and I want to tell about my sister, who is 5 years older than me and was in the hospital and very sick and under pain. And I hope you would go in prayer with me for my sister.
Hi, my name is Claire. Just a candle of support for my brother, who was home for 2 weeks, and it was really great to see him again. My sister-in-law, Laura, was also here with us for about a week, and then she went to Canada to visit family. And it was just a joy to have all of us here home, and also just to spend some time with my brother and hearing him laugh again. And also a candle of concern for my high school mentor. He is somebody I do care about. He is having spinal fusion surgery this week. So if you could just have a little prayer for him. Thank you.
My name's Lynn. A candle for my nephew Alex, who has acknowledged that sometimes you just need others to help you through a difficult time. So he's getting the help he needs, hopefully.
I will light one final candle for the joys and concerns we keep in our hearts. So we have a piece of music coming up. This piece of music we're about to hear is called The Waltz in D Flat Major, Opus 64, Number 1. Valse du Petit Chien. My French is not good. It's actually non-existent. It was composed by Frédéric Chopin. It is popularly known as the not as the minute waltz, if you read it like I would in the order of service, but as the minute waltz, as in the sense of a miniature or small waltz. Chopin never intended it to be played in just a minute, so it's going to be longer than a minute long. It is 138 measures long and would have to be played at 420 quarter notes per minute to be that quick. But Nancy's probably going to give it her best shot. Nancy noted that her metronome does not even go that fast. It only goes up to 208. So one of Chopin's biographers indicates that the inspiration for the waltz came from watching a small dog chase its tail, thus the composer's name for it in French for the Little Dog Waltz. Regardless of how it's measured, please listen and enjoy. through that whole thing, a large ballroom with little dogs just chasing their tails. Our first reading comes from one of my favorite poets, Billy Collins. It's called What I Learned Today. I had never heard of John Bernard Flanagan, American sculptor, until I found him on page 961 of the single-volume encyclopedia I am reading at the rate of one page each day. He was so poor, according to the entry, he could not afford the good quarried marble and instead had to carve animals out of the field stones he gathered until he committed suicide in 1942, the year, I can't help thinking, I turned one. Of course I know what flannel is, but that French flannel is napped on only one side is new to me, and a reminder that no matter what the size of the aquarium of one's learning, another colored pebble can always be dropped in. Tonight, a fog blows by the windows, and a mist falls through the porch lights as my index finger descends from flat-coated retriever to flatfish, those sideways creatures, chervil, plaice, flounder, sole, all swimming through the dark with close-set eyes, toothless, twisted mouths, and a preference for warm, shallow water. But this is nothing new to me. No dots are connected in the vast grid of my autodidacticism. No branch is pruned in the forest of my ignorance, which is why I am stepping over the Flathead River of Canada and Montana's Flathead Lake and coming to rest on the Flathead Indians, who never actually practiced head flattening, I am disappointed to learn, but got their name from the neighboring tribes who shaped the front of their heads to achieve a pointed appearance, which is how I hope to look when the entire contents of this book press against the inside of my high forehead. What a relief to emerge from all this flat-headedness and land on Flaubert, son of a surgeon, victim of a nervous disorder and pursuer of Le Mouge. Yet the entry for the supreme master of the realistic novel is no taller than a filtered cigarette, and hardly half the size of the piscatory word puff that envelops the subject of flatfish. Posterity is indeed a cruel and savagely attired mistress, but my own slow, sentimental education must continue with the revelation, while that there were three emperors and a Catholic patriarch all named Flavian, there's only one, Dan Flavin, another sculptor who works, the bottom of the narrow column tells me, in the medium of fluorescent lights, luminous tubes strangely configured. The hour is late as I mark my place with a playing card and close the book in my lap. A cool vapor flows over the windowsills. Appalachia is behind me. Napoleon lies ahead. And I will save for tomorrow the subject of flax, the chief source of fiber and seed oil from prehistoric times to the development of cotton. It is time to float on the waters of the night, time to wrap my arms around this book and to press it to my chest, life preserver in a sea of unremarkable men and women, anonymous faces on the street, 100,000 unalphabetized things, 1,000,000 forgotten hours. Please join me for a few moments of silent thought, meditation, or the spirit of prayer. our second reading, our excerpts from What Do We Measure and Why? By Margaret Wheatley and Myron Kellner Rogers. We live in a culture that is crazy about numbers. We seek standardization. We revere precision, and we aspire for control. The very ancient and dominant belief of Western culture is that numbers are what is real. If you can number it, you make it real. Once made real, it's yours to manage and control. We increasingly depend on numbers to know how we are doing for virtually everything. We ascertain our health with numbers. What's your IQ? What's your GPA? Your emotional intelligence? And of course, we judge organizational viability only with numbers. What's the customer satisfaction rating? Inventory turns? ROI? PE ratio? It is numbers, and only numbers, that define and make visible what is real. This is the hard stuff, the real world of management, graphs, charts, indices, ratios. Everyone knows that you can only manage what you can measure. The work of modern managers is to interpret and manipulate those numeric views of reality. The desire to be good managers has compelled many people to become earnest students of measurement. But are measures and numbers the right pursuit? We'd like you to consider this question. What are the problems in organizations for which we assume measure are the solutions? Most managers want reliable, high-quality work. They want commitment, focus, teamwork, learning, and quality. They want people to pay attention to those things that contribute to performance. We believe that these behaviors are never produced by measurement. They are performance capabilities that emerge as people feel connected to their work and to each other. They are capacities that emerge as colleagues develop a shared sense of what they hope to create together, and as they operate in an environment where everyone feels welcome to contribute and to that shared hope. Each of these qualities and behaviors, commitment, focus, teamwork, learning, quality, is a choice people make. To look at prevailing organizational practice, most managers seem consistently to choose measurement as a route to these capacities. Ironically, the longer we try to garner these behaviors through measurement and reward, the more damage we do to the quality of our relationships, and the more we trivialize the meaning of work. The path of measurement can lead us dangerously far from the organizational qualities and behaviors that we require. But measurement is critical. It can provide something that is essential to sustenance and growth, feedback. All life thrives on feedback and dies without it. We have to know what is going on around us, how our actions impact others, how the environment is changing, how we're changing. If we don't have access to this kind of information, we can't adapt or grow. We want to use measurement to give us the kind and quality of feedback that supports and welcomes people to step forward with their desire, to contribute, to learn, and to achieve. We want measurement to be used from a deeper place of understanding, the understanding that the real capacity of an organization arises when colleagues willingly struggle together in a common work that they love. Please rise in body or spirit and join in singing our centering hymn, number 350, The Ceaseless Flow of Endless Time. my movie, which I will never make, will open with a single long take that starts with a blistering view of the sun through black filters. The surface of the sun, like fire and light, congealed into lava, filling the whole view, and the camera drifting back from the sun in a continuous zoom, the filter slowly thinning so that the sun burns more and more brightly, even as it shrinks in the frame. We see the corona, the heliosphere, the solar wind streaming outward. The definition and imperfections of the sun diminish as the camera glides further and further away, till at last we sink through our own atmosphere, zooming back across an expanse of water that the sun floats above. And here, the camera movement changes. As it zooms, it begins to rise, still moving back from the sun, until the straight edge of a road running along a cliff seems to rise out of the bottom of the frame, until the road fills the lower half of the frame, and the line of its upper edge forms a perfect tangent to the circle of the sun. The camera stops moving, sun centered in the frame, sitting on that perfectly level tangent of the road. A bicycle and rider enter the frame from the far left, also balanced on the line of the road, and the wheels of the bicycle are the same size as the sun. And as the front wheel of the bicycle passes in silhouette in front of the sun, encircling it with a black outline, it is as if the sun catches in the wheel and begins to roll with it to the right of the frame. The title of the film appears in letters that rotate up from the wheel and are deposited along the line of the road, and the title says, How to Measure a Year. I'm not sure what kind of movie this will be. Could be a science fiction adventure, as the whole shot of the opening sequence starts in space. But if it is, I think it'll be a near future one, where we are just beyond the cusp of now. Perhaps there will be hovercraft, wearable computers, self-driving cars, nanomachines, and cats that control the internet. Maybe it will try to capture a certain kind of film noir, a detective feel, a mystery needing to be solved. There could be the slow turning of ceiling fans, long shadows, stylish hats, and the omnipresence of steam and smoke and fog. Or maybe it could be a musical, something along the lines of Dr. Horrible's sing-along blog. In the end, I don't think it will matter if it's science fiction, film noir, comedy, drama, musical, or art film, because at core, it will be a philosophical love story. Which is a bit redundant, since philosophy is already the love of wisdom. How to measure a year. We love to measure things. We love numbers. And when we measure things, we get numbers. And these numbers become simplified descriptions and markers. The measurements are useful. We check the temperature to tell us whether we need to wear a coat or not, or as one of my friends at work says, whether I have to put on pants or not. We get the score of a football game so we know whether we know something about the outcome without having watched it. We check the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the NASDAQ, and the S&P 500 to get an idea of whether the economy is functioning well. As we become accustomed to various numbers, they take on their own kind of reality. We often forget that we, as a culture, made them up, or at least how to calculate them. At some point, the year 2014 becomes just another number, that one between 2013 and 2015. But suppose an alien showed up at your house one day, landed on your lawn, rang your doorbell. Suppose it happened to be just after midnight on January 1st, 2015, when you answered the door. So when you opened it, you said, Happy New Year! Welcome to the future! And the alien looked at you and said, What's a year? How would you go about answering that question? Well, you might say, a year is the time it takes the Earth to travel once around the sun. A year is a journey around the sun. A circle, you might say, to keep things simple. A year, in turn, is broken up into smaller units of days, the amount of time it takes the Earth to turn around once on its axis. You could show a calendar, a clock, the months, weeks, days, hours, minutes, seconds. A year is 365 days of 24 hours each day, you might say. And the alien might ask, why are there 12 months? What is a month? Why are there weeks? Why is a week 7 days? Why is this year only 2015? Hasn't your planet traveled around your sun more times than that? And are you aware that your planet's orbital period does not align with its rotation on its axis? You are actually celebrating your year too early if it's only 365 days long. How do you adjust for that extra quarter of a day, additional day each year? Well, you might say, our current Gregorian calendar was built using parts from a previous calendar, in particular the Julian calendar, inherited from the Romans, and the Hebrew calendar. So a week comes from the Hebrew story of creation, where God creates the world in 7 days. So weeks are 7-day cycles of the story of creation. And the idea of 12 months comes from the Hebrew and other lunar-based calendars. And you would explain how Earth's moon waxes and wanes, and then how 12 of these lunar cycles was considered a year, but that such a lunar year was only around 354.37 days, as the cycle of the moon neither ties to the rotation of the Earth on its axis or to its orbit around the sun. And a year being so short would throw off the starting date of the seasons over time and cause farmers problems on when to plant if corrections weren't made. So the lunar calendar needed to be adjusted, either by extending the number of days in each month by adding a leap month every so often. Well, in addition, the use of 12 has ties to the movement of the stars, the zodiac as seen from Earth, not to mention the 12 gods of Olympus, which the Romans borrowed from the Greeks, and the 12 tribes of Israel, and the 12 apostles of Christianity. Also, not to mention that 12 is the smallest whole number, evenly divisible by 2, 3, and 4. You might note that the Hebrew calendar numbered the years in Anno Mundi, years since the Earth was created, and its New Year's Day is offset from our current Gregorian New Year's. Thus, the current year, as of your New Year's Day of January 1st, 2015, on the Hebrew calendar was still Anno Mundi 5775, and then it would not end until sunset on September 13th. Of 2015, at which point it would become Anno Mundi 5776. The Romans, in contrast, would refer to their years not with numbers, but the names of the two consuls that held office that year. But since there's no consuls, and their epoch was defined as Ab Urbe Condita, the AUC that I'm sure you have on your calendars, meaning from the founding of Rome, then the current year for a Roman would actually be 2767 AUC. However, current year numbers, thanks to Dionysius Exiguus, known as Dennis the Small, I'm sure you studied him in like third grade, you probably just don't remember, were recalculated based on the birth of Christ. Thus, your Gregorian calendar names the year as 2015 AD Anno Domini, since the birth of Christ, which is also referred to as the Common Era, CE. You note that the extra quarter day is made up with the addition of a day in February once every 4 years, that is, in years evenly divisible by 4, unless the year is also evenly divisible by 100, but not 400, in which case no leap year is added, leap day is added. You decide not to mention that the Thai solar calendar has an effect based on the day of the death of Gautama Buddha, and thus its year is 2557, and its New Year's festival is on April 13th. The alien looks at you, shaking its head, and finally asks, "Why don't you fix your planet and moon?" We are not living far enough in our own future to have the scientific capability to do that, you say. What you opt to not say is that even if we could fix the rotation of the Earth and the waxing and waning of the moon like some kind of watchmaker fixing a watch, maybe we wouldn't want to. Maybe we would want to keep our strange history of calendars and imperfect timings. There is something about the imperfection that challenges us, that reminds us that we're human, that these numbers are our numbers. I'm not sure how I will portray all of this in my movie yet, but this is just barely touches on how we begin to measure a year. If you were to sit entirely still in a chair on the equator, you would still be moving at 1,000 miles per hour relative to the axis of the Earth. You would be moving at 66,000 miles per hour relative to the Sun. The Sun, and thus the Earth and the rest of the solar system, would be moving at 43,000 miles per hour toward Vega, a bright star about 25 light years from us. The Sun and solar system would also be turning in our arm of the Milky Way galaxy around the core of the Milky Way at 483,000 miles per hour. And scientists estimate, using Doppler shifts based on the background radiation frequencies, that our whole Milky Way galaxy is traveling at 1.3 million miles per hour in the general direction of the sky, defined by the constellations of Leo and Virgo. And none of this is really noticeable to us. Also, mentioning any of this to a police officer to try and get out of a speeding ticket is very unlikely to work. Using scientific knowledge in units of measure is certainly a valid way of measuring a year. But such measurements, as difficult and tricky as they are not really the ones we think about most of the time. Instead, our approach in measuring a year is usually non-scientific. We think of the year as a journey. And what is important are not the miles and the speed of the Earth, or when the year begins or ends, or how we number that particular revolution, but rather the events that occur on the journey of the year, events that happen to us and how they affect us, human events, history. The end of every year is filled with various websites, news sites, magazines, and newspapers that review the year for us, and they try to sum it up. They contain lists of the best and worst of this and that. In looking at 2014, we find the year contained such events as water vapor found on Ceres, a death toll of over 130,000 in the Syrian Civil War, a revolt in Ukraine, Crimea declaring itself a republic, Ebola outbreaks, rising deaths in Guinea and Liberia, the disappearance of Malaysian Airlines Flight 370, fighting between Israel and Hamas, protests in Ferguson, Missouri, the Rosetta mission probe being landed on a comet, Obama announcing immigration changes, normalized relationships between the U.S. and Cuba, ongoing climate changes. Although such piles of information are fascinating, they are like that single-volume encyclopedia that Billy Collins reads in the poem What I Learned Today. They are usually bare and disconnected facts. They do not have any meaning to us in and of themselves. How do we digest all of this information? What gets included or excluded from these lists? If, as part of the measure of the year, we try to compare it to another year, how do we decide if this year was better or worse than the previous year? Are things getting better overall for the world, for your own country, for our state, for our community, like LCUUC, for each of us personally? Or, as Grumpy Cat expects, are we facing an apocalypse, albeit a slow and somewhat disappointing one in terms of cinematic spectacle? With the official end of the year, 2014, based on our flawed but nonetheless functional calendars, we create a cut point in time, and thus we will be seeing statistics coming out from the United Nations, from various government bureaus, from think tanks, and any number of different groups, rolling up facts and figures for the year. Things like total population, births and deaths, gross domestic product, spending on military, spending on education, and so forth. In and of themselves, many of these numbers do not tell us what is important or what we need to do to accentuate the positive and eliminate the negative. Such statistics by themselves do not indicate how we should behave. As Margaret Wheatley and Myron Kellner Rogers note in what do we measure and why, we sometimes spend a lot of time presenting numbers. For instance, the latest one I have seen is the number of traffic deaths in Wisconsin that gets posted to those recently added message boards along I-94. In 2014, there were a total of 491 traffic fatalities in Wisconsin. This, according to the Wisconsin Department of Transportation website, is the lowest number of fatalities since 1943. And that's wonderful. But is simply presenting that statistic expected to somehow change people's driving behavior and reduce fatalities even more? Is the measurement acting as feedback to the drivers? Or is it just a number? Wheatley and Kellner Rogers note that measurement is critical because it can provide feedback. By gathering statistics, like the number of traffic fatalities year over year, we can analyze and see trends, and with the right information, we can find patterns and take actions to reduce those numbers. But feedback is different from measurement. The number of traffic deaths is a measurement. Perhaps presenting the measure in a kind of real time to actual drivers begins to approach a feedback of some sort by raising your awareness. But a feedback system is really more like those radar speed signs that say, your current speed is, and there it is, popping up on the display. According to Wheatley and Kellner Rogers, feedback differs from measure in the following ways. Feedback is self-generated. The individual or system notices what they determine is important. Feedback depends on context. What is happening now? Feedback interacts and changes. New and surprising information can get in. Boundaries of feedback are permeable. Feedback provides essential information to maintain one's existence. It indicates when adaptation and growth are necessary. Feedback supports movement toward fitness. Both the individual and the environment co-evolve toward mutual sustainability. In order to finally measure a year, what we need beyond the science of measure, which only gives us ways to measure length, mass, time, electrical current, luminous intensity, amount of substance, and thermodynamic temperature, and what we need beyond the events of the year, that conglomeration of historic happenings from which we can derive statistics of all kinds and compare them for trends and changes, but which lack any deeper meaning, what we need is a set of core values, a philosophy that points us to what we want to create, what we want to strengthen, what we want to preserve. Whether we, like Billy Collins in the poem What I Learned Today, can hold a book of knowledge to our chests like a life preserver in a sea of unremarkable men and women, anonymous faces on the street, 100,000 unalphabetized things, 1,000,000 forgotten hours, is going to depend on what our values and philosophy are. Our principles as Unitarians let us move from being passive observers and measurers to becoming active participants in that sea, to be able to discover what is remarkable about each person that we meet, to name them, to create a community, out of those unalphabetized things, to apply our time to creating something, to imbue history with our meaning. We will come to recognize that our life is a project which is guided by our principles and resolutions, and that we measure a year by the meaning that we bring to it. We have some time at this point, so I'm going to open a polylog for the first time in a while to hear from you. So it's the beginning of the new year. I'm curious if anyone out there makes resolutions. What sort of resolutions do you make? How do they tie to your Unitarian principles? What sort of things do you see yourself doing in this coming year? So we've got the microphones out here. If you raise your hand and you have a comment or question or you want to talk about a resolution, raise your hand. Or duck. Everybody could duck.
I
Hello?
Oh,
this is Jessie again. And I actually have a New Year's resolution this year. I even started it early, so I'm pretty proud about this. You can tell already. And it's to not use plastic bags when I'm shopping. So I have a couple of those that, you know, just fold down small and you can carry them right in your pocket. And I gave them away as gifts this year for Christmas, too, and got to share that idea with whoever I got a bunch of them and handed them out. But I just, you know, just trying to save the world one plastic bag at a time.
I'm Carrie, and mine kind of goes along with your theme. As I was rushing around in the holidays and things were hectic and crazy, I just woke up on New Year's Day and decided this year my resolution is to slow down and savor the moments. See how you can check in with me and tell me how I'm doing.
Do we have to talk about resolutions, or can we respond to yours?
No, you can respond.
Okay, this is Mary, and it was a topic that's kind of near and dear to my heart because I do lots and lots of data analysis and data collection and use that information as much as I can to try to communicate things about the organization that I'm in. And I think that I know that you weren't trying to diss the concept of measurement, but I find that really people generally don't wish to use measurement. They wish to use gut feel and anecdote and impressions. And they value those things way more than they do data. And I find this to be a constant personal struggle because I feel that there's a great deal of ignorance about how much gut feel and impression and anecdotes are influenced by personal bias and how very, very unreliable they are. So an example of that, one of the things I measure a lot of is representation of women and racial ethnic minorities in engineering. And if I talk to a group of listeners, they will tell me that we're doing great in the place that I work because they see so many women around and they've noticed there's so many women in their classrooms. And when I tell them, well, you know, the numbers haven't changed since 1992, they go, well, that's not possible. For example, you know, my sister's an engineer. I go, okay.
So I was going to invent a new phrase this year. So we talk to people when they mumble or they don't say. Usually the little kids, we say, use your words. Don't, you know, describe what you want, what you feel, and so on. Maybe we need to come up with a new phrase. Use your numbers. Don't just categorically say, oh, you know, there's a million things out there that are bothering me. Be more accurate than that. You know, there's actually 327 things that are bothering me, and here they are.
Hi, I'm Barb. As one of those people who tends to examine the world entirely too much from my gut and my intuition and my heart, and I'm soft and fuzzy and... Mary, thank you. That's a wake-up call.
Jesse, pardon me, I've lost my voice the last 3 weeks with my bronchitis. I don't know when I'm ever going to get it back. But anyway, Jesse reminded me of a resolution we can all do this year. Now that Waukesha County has made it a lot easier for us to recycle, we don't have to bring number 5 plastic into the church. Just throw it in your own recycling bin.
What about the fluorescent bulbs?
You can still bring your CFLs here, although if you take them to the hardware store, they'll probably take them too.
I'm going to challenge everybody this year to learn metric. So go and look up what the temperature is today in Celsius. Buy your food in, you know, metric containers. It's supposed to just liter jugs. Figure out what your gallon of milk actually is. the U.S. is one of the few countries that doesn't bother to continue to really use metric effectively. And it's hard because I would have a very hard time baking it with something other than tablespoons and teaspoons and cups.
My name is Rebecca. I try not to use the word resolution because I feel like then it'll not last. But I was also raised up in a very scientific mindset, and actually this year I'm trying to quiet myself and access my intuition more.
This is Lynn. This year, I'm going to pay special attention to my yums and my yucks, is how I'm looking at it. So when something presents itself, does that feel like a yum or a yuck? Do I want to do that or don't I want to do that?
This is Yvonne. I struggle to trust a lot of the numbers. I think you can use them in so many different ways. You can skew them. Numbers require interpretation. And so for me, it's the balance between, well, this is one way to look at it, and are there other ways that might be more useful? Or, put it in part of the mix that, I've seen is numbers just... people lie, to get the numbers, but also require interpretation.
Definitely. I think not only do the numbers require interpretation, but events in history, the same thing. It doesn't have to just be a number. We're constantly interpreting. So we have to look to our values. What are the things that are important? What do we pull out of those to make them useful? I'm going to challenge people, if you want some interesting reads, you can pick up the books Freakonomics. There's two Freakonomic books out there that take an approach to the world that is very number-based, which is like, how do I take numbers and economics, which we think of as the flow of money, and discover things about ourselves and about our world, and what sort of things can they tell us, and how do you play those to see a view that you don't see on a day-to-day basis? So that you see that wider view of the world besides just that your sister is an engineer. You see how many women are actually in the field, how many things are actually changing out there. One of the things I was going to mention is I think we're missing a concept of measurement, a human-based concept of measurement. So you can think about this and see if you can invent a new word this year. What is the force of will? How do we measure our force of will to change things? How do we measure the concept of giving some sense of our spirit or sending a prayer out to people? Is there such a thing as a love per square foot or, something along those lines that you can invent to sort of say, this is what we're throwing at the world energy-wise to make it different. Is there anybody else? We've got two more, and then we'll wrap up the service, and we can talk in the social hall.
Hi, I'm Terry. Well, I was thinking sometimes we hurt ourselves when we judge ourselves based on numbers. The two things that came to my mind was, number one, how we judge ourselves based on how much money we have, how much money we make, what kind of a house we live in or what kind of a car we drive, and that's a measurement of our worth. The other measurement that I was thinking of that certainly trips me up, and I know a lot of other people fall into this trap, is the measurement of personal weight and how we judge each other and ourselves based on the number of pounds that we weigh.
I'm Janice, and I read a good book a little over a year ago, Thinking Fast and Slow, and that's on numbers too. And one of the ways they describe how we often substitute our emotions for numbers was what, because it's easier, is, for example, like if you're buying stocks, and you might, instead of looking at like price earnings ratio or something, you might think, do I like that company? And they gave lots of examples of how, I mean, there are times that it's natural and important to think with your intuition. If you come into a room, is it that person safe? But then there are times that we need to think with slow thinking, and in that case, that was doing the harder work. So, and then I just, one other thing I wanted to mention, a numbers thing that Jim and I learned on emotions was, you know, when you disagree about something, how strongly you feel about it, and you could use a number from 1 to 10, and most of the time mine is a 10, but it does help to have a way to quantify that.
Thank you, everyone. So we'll wrap up. Take the flame from this chalice into your heart and let it shine with your strength and beauty. Our closing hymn is number 128, For All That Is Our Life. So please rise in body or spirit and join in singing our closing hymn. As you go back out into the world again, listen once more to the words from Tom Robbins. Our greatest human adventure is the evolution of consciousness. We are in this life to enlarge the soul, liberate the spirit, and light up the brain. Don't add these to a list of resolutions or a bucket list of experiences. Make them part of everything you do in the world. Thank you.
testimony.